Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 271 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. How are you?
I'm very warm, thank you.
I'll get to that in a minute. So, so we've been doing this for like 5 years. I just punched the crap out of the microphone. I won't be able to get that out. So please make sure that you go over to the appropriate places and you press like and subscribe and do those things for YouTube. And if you can write a review on your podcast app. Oh, and let me say this one other thing. Somebody keeps telling me to do this. Just in case, if you become a patron, then you can listen to us record this live, which happens on Saturday nights, almost only, because busy schedules and all that. But Saturday nights at 7 o'clock Eastern time. If you tell me anything about any other time zones, it doesn't matter. I don't care. Eastern is the only one that matters. Unless, Larry, we're in Central time zone, then Central's the only one that matters. So it's where I am that matters. Is that fair?
I would say it's completely logical.
So you can find the show over on podcast apps, all that stuff. But the final thing that I want to mention before we actually roll into this is if you do have a question, we've gotten a bunch of questions lately. If you have a question, you can certainly email it to us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com, or you can leave a voicemail or send a voice memo to the previous email address, but 747-227-4477. I think that's all the announcements I want to make before we roll in. This is going to be a quick show because, Larry, I think it's like, tell me what we're going to do this evening. I'll cover the weather in a moment.
Well, we're going to be doing a very abbreviated session, but we have a case from California that's pending in federal U.S. District Court there. Launched by the Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offense Laws. And we're going to be discussing a case out of Idaho that's gone up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it's back on remand. And an order has been issued on that case. We've got something from a listener. And then we've got stuff about the hovercraft. Both of us have experienced hovercraft in the last week.
Yes, we have. Hey, do you want to tell me, like, we're going to do an abbreviated session this evening for some unknown reason. What is that reason?
Well, it's 97 outside, and in the building here, it's 89.4.
Oh, God. And that's because of, did your boss not pay the electric bill?
No, it has to do with a replaced AC unit that cools our section. They replaced it about 4 years ago and it didn't hold up, and it's down again, and it's been down for a week and a half, and they've blamed the holidays and all these different things.
Holidays made the AC go out?
In terms of getting technicians over here. But yes. Actually, they've had technicians, and I don't think they're fully qualified, and I think they actually caused the problem by incompetence.
Hey, the way you just described that, though, is another part of the building cool?
Oh, yes, the entire building. There's like 26 suites, and we control four of them. This unit controls and cools our four plus one more, so it's just us. And the person has the fifth suite. And he's gone for the summer. So it's kind of funny that we're the only ones that don't have cooling.
I'm laughing because, yes, that is funny that if it's really only impacting you, other than it's really not cool. Literally not cool, because that's not cool. Well, since we're going to keep this abbreviated so that you don't melt and you get very cranky when you're uncomfortably warm, we will dive right into this show, and we'll begin with comment from listener. And it goes, we feel sometimes rare. Larry stops short from thinking outside the box to help a PFR get around the rules using the law/rules like Castman. For example, on episode 250, Larry describes a case of a person convicted in 1993, and Wisconsin did not require him to register because his conviction predated the registry. He moves to Nevada, which makes him register. then moved back to Wisconsin, which now required him to register because he had been on the registry in another state. Then he decided to go to New Mexico to get off the registry because they didn't require him to register because their registry started in 1995. Then he went back. God, this is convoluted, Larry. Then he went back to Wisconsin, but now he's off the registry. This kind of thinking is outside the box. Yet, in episode 254, a 70-year-old who wanted to join his wife in the Philippines didn't receive the acumen that we'd hoped from you. Larry said, but anyway, let's assume that your state, wherever you're going to be, that required that you file your 21-day advance notice as required by federal law with your local registration. They will transmit it to the U.S. Marshals, who will then in turn transmit it internationally to Interpol. And Interpol will make sure the destination country has it. Well, there's where you could run into the problem. The destination country, having received that notice, well, in many instances, when you arrive, they will tell you, sorry, we're not admitting you into our country, which is their prerogative. And you'll be facing a very expensive return flight to the United States. And that is what is going to happen, which is technically correct, but still not helpful. We hope that Larry would say, tell the sheriff you are going to Germany, buy a ticket to Germany, and when you land in Germany, you can go anywhere you want, and you do not have to report to anyone anything. Now, could the Philippines still bar him from entry? Absolutely. But how or why? They didn't receive any notice on him. They usually are very welcoming to Americans. We doubt they would scrutinize him or to look for the PFR stamp on his passport or if they even know what it is. We are only trying to circumvent that notice or letter from reaching the airport staff. Otherwise, no one is going to bother a 70-year-old with an American passport. Why Germany? You should know why after interviewing Steve River Witset, episode 195. There are two cases to cite that SORNA has no jurisdiction outside U.S. borders. Lester Ray Nichols versus United States 578 U.S. SCOTUS. We can't remember the second one. Similar. Now, Larry, may I channel my inner Larry and answer for you? And you, I bet you're going to say you have no experience with international travel.
Well, that is true. One of the things I would say, yes, thanks.
All right. So I've taken over your job. Why do we even need you? What else would you say, though? I'm sure there's more that you would say to that.
Well, he submitted a number of things. We're going to get to him in turn, not on this episode, but my heart was just so, it just touched my heart that he articulated what I said about the person from Wisconsin who went to Nevada. I mean, if he didn't use our transcript service, he did a good job, because that is pretty much what I said. And too often people say things that I didn't say, or they misconstrue what they think that I said, but that's pretty spot on what I said.
Yeah, that was definitely using the transcript.
But what I didn't say on this case was, I have a great fear of the federal people, their prosecutorial powers when they do have jurisdiction. And clearly, when it comes to international travel, the feds do have some jurisdiction in terms of before you depart and the truthfulness of those statements that you make to them. So I'm not about to sit here ever and tell people to do things to circumvent what's required at their jurisdiction. I can only imagine what would happen if I did and I said, well, gee, you could kind of dodge it and play this little game and tell them you're going here and then actually go there. That's one of the reasons why they put that marker on the passport, was to try to prevent people from being able to do that undetected. My other concern is that his passport is probably in the system, and even when it gets scanned in the Philippines, even though they didn't receive a notice, he still might be turned back. Then we sent him on two trips. But I appreciate where he's coming from, but I can't bring myself to advise people to do things that would be circumventing the law. The case from New Mexico, that guy called me and he told me he had that plan. He had researched the law, and I think I said that on the program, as a matter of fact. He said he had researched the law and he asked me would it work. And I said, well, looking at the research, your research is accurate. And I would tell you that I can't find any fault with your logic. And it did work for him.
So are you okay with this comment? I'm trying to get a feel. Did this rub you the wrong way at all, or is this just we're kind of going down and taking the points of what the person is describing?
Not at all. It didn't rub me the wrong way. I'm just letting people know that I'm going to have a hard time advising people to try to circumvent the law. There are some organizations that may do that, but I'm going to have a hard time doing that because the consequences are significant. When you're facing a federal prosecution, you're looking at significant time. And as we go down to this program tonight, we're going to be talking about people who fear prosecutions that I think are even far stretched, far less likely to happen than what this could be. When you tell Florida that you're going to one country and then you quickly leave that country and go to another, it's possible that the feds may pick up on that and there could be a prosecution. So I just can't bring myself to advise people to do that.
Yeah, and anytime anybody's asking about how they should handle their probation officer, this or that, can they do that? Like, you should just totally listen to what they say. It may be wrong, and you should fight a different way, but you got to do what they tell you to do.
That is correct.
When you say a significant federal prosecution time, like, how much time are you talking about if you traveled overseas without notifying them, and then when you come back, how much time would you get for that?
Well, I hear anywhere from a range of a year in federal prison to 5 or 10 years in federal prison for violating federal requirements. And
come
clearly,
on, man, you could do that holding your breath.
Clearly, I don't want to do 1 year, much less 5 years.
All right. Well, again, we will keep things short so that you don't melt. We have this at least two people, if not more, reached out to me directly to ask me about this SORNA Axol thing. And so this is from the Pacific Legal Foundation and the Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offense Laws, otherwise known as Axol. Do you want to cover this right now?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. A listener sent us a link about this case. And again, then somebody even like text messaged me that I met at a conference a few years ago. It states, a federal court today issued a decision that denies a motion to dismiss two claims filed in the U.S. Department of Justice in the pending SORNA lawsuit. The focus of the decision is the application of the recently issued SORNA regulations. This came from the Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offense Laws, otherwise known as AXOL. As I recall, you're not a big fan of this case. Do you want to remind us why not?
Well, I do not see that the issue is ripe for determination yet. There has been no hint of prosecution by the federal government of anyone who has been relieved of their duty to registration by a state. And I say relieved of, and I mean by either timing out and receiving a letter that your time has expired or that you've gone through a judicial process. The federal government has said nothing. They've hinted nothing.
I'm not in California, but this would be me because I had a judge say that I could come off the registry.
That is correct. And there has been nothing, not even a peep. So these issues are not ripe for litigation yet, in my opinion. And I continue to maintain that opinion despite the trajectory of this case, which is still ongoing.
And then, so what are the main issues that are going on with this challenge?
Well, according to Axol, I'm reading from their statement, the federal government has argued in the past that SORNA regulations apply to every person convicted of a sex offense unless there has been a court finding of innocence. And the plaintiffs have argued that SORNA regulations apply only to those who are currently required to register. Their theory is that the government might prosecute a person who is no longer has a duty to register. That's their theory, but there's not been a hint of that.
And to provide some context and background, on January 13th of 2023, the court granted a motion for preliminary injunction. The court held that the individual plaintiffs, apart from Mr. Doe's one, indisputably demonstrated standing, but it declined to reach the question of whether Mr. Doe, number one, or Axol had standing. As to the merit of the plaintiffs' claims, the court held that they demonstrated a likelihood of success on their due process claim and a substantial question going to the merits on the First Amendment claim. Plaintiffs did not demonstrate a likelihood of success on their non-delegation and APA. So can you remind me what APA is?
I believe it's Administrative Practices Act.
Okay. The government asked that the case be dismissed. What is the legal standard to survive such a motion?
According to the court, To survive a motion to dismiss, a plaintiff must allege enough facts to state a claim that relief is plausible on its face.
Would you mind if you could dumb that down specifically for me, because I did not understand? What is the plausibility standard?
I thought it made sense. It means that the complaint on its face, as written, with a presumption that all is true, would entitle the person to relief. Some people file complaints for a perceived wrong, but the law does not entitle them to any relief, even though they have suffered a wrong. The Ninth Circuit has clarified that to survive such a motion, a complaint must, one, contain sufficient allegations of underlying facts to give fair notice and to enable the opposing party to defend itself effectively, and two, the factual allegations that are taken as true must plausibly suggest an entitlement to relief, such as that it's not unfair to require the opposing party to be subjective to the expense of discovery and continued litigation. Meaning that litigation is expensive. You're paying an attorney or a legal team to defend you. And if the complaint on its face, as you read it, assuming it's all true, there's no vehicle to award you relief under the law, then you shouldn't have to continue to expend money. So that's what that motion is for.
According to Axall, the court criticized the federal government, stating that the Department of Justice has not provided any clarification or further explanation regarding the applicability of the regulations. Instead, the court noted that the federal government has asserted that it need not concern itself with the peculiarities of state law, even though most individuals are convicted in state court, not federal court, of a PFR-type offense. Why can't you see the potential threat here, Mr. Larry?
Because, again, there hasn't been the slightest hint that these new regulations change the status quo. I don't know why that's so hard to understand. What I think that they were looking for when they did these regulations, they were trying to give the states an invitation and the roadmap to how to administratively implement the full plethora of requirements of the AWA, because many states had failed to do it legislatively. I don't think they were looking to upend the people who have been released from the registry. Now, if, for example, if a state would want to include those who've already been discharged and they're looking and angling for bringing them back, if a state has such sinister intentions, these new regulations would provide them that roadmap. But as far as the federal government, there has not been a hint, the slightest of hint of the prosecution. So that's why I can't see it.
The reason why you can't see it is because you are too stubborn. Even the judge disagrees with you, Larry. The judge noted that if the court were to accept the federal government's assertion regarding applicability of the regulations, many offenders across the country who cannot register with their states are apparently supposed to hope that they are not prosecuted by the federal government, and if they are, they should try to prove impossibility at trial. What are people supposed to do in Larry's perfect world? Just hope for the best?
No, you don't need to just hope for the best. A person would wait until the DOJ announces that it will prosecute anyone who's been released from registration. If that person would still be defined as a PFR under the federal definition. They have not announced that yet. At that time, there would be a plethora of arguments that could be made to combat the government. The risk now is that we will get a decision that answers the question that isn't ripe, nor have the arguments been fully developed. Remember the Willman case from Michigan?
Remind me of some of those arguments from the Willman case.
Well, I didn't assert those arguments in the Willman case, but that was a case where they threw everything with the kitchen sink, saying that there was no federal registry. And they got a decision from the Sixth Circuit saying there's an independent federal duty to register. Folks, you do not want that coming down from the Ninth Circuit. I don't know why that's hard to understand. You don't want the federal judge, if the federal judge agrees with Axell and the Pacific Legal Foundation, it's going to be appealed. And you do not want an unfavorable decision yet. But what are some of those arguments? If if this were to be developed, I would want to develop it. There'd be several. First, we would argue that there's lack of federal jurisdiction over registration since there is no federal registry. That's a simple argument. Ain't no federal registry, period. So therefore, there's no federal jurisdiction to enforce registry. Now, people are going to say, well, Larry, don't you understand people get prosecuted all the time? Yes, they do, because they transfer from one state to another. They move, relocate. What do they call it? Interstate commerce. They travel in interstate commerce, and they do not register in the new state. That's when there is a federal jurisdictional hook. But that is an undeveloped argument, and it will not be developed in this case. Second, we would argue that the doctrine of federalism, and that's that the specifically the things that are not enumerated as federal jurisdiction are delegated to the states. And conservatives generally are fond of that argument of protecting states from the overreaching federal government. That isn't being developed in this case the way it's postured right now. And third, we would argue that the regulations, if applied to a person who has been released from registration by court order, that they would be undoing a judicial order. And that violates the separation of powers doctrine. We've got good arguments. We're not in a venue that allows these arguments to be developed. We're arguing about the Administrative Practices Act. We're arguing about the language of the regulations. And we're arguing about a hypothetical that maybe someday, somewhere, someone might be prosecuted. And so I'm afraid of this litigation.
I was in the Army, and there were some things about trajectory, like with rockets flying over and whatnot. So what does the term trajectory mean as far as a legal case goes?
Well, it means right now, this decision means that this case lives on. The government was not able to extinguish it, and that Axel will have its day in court. That's what it means.
And today's decision is a significant victory for registrants and their loved ones, stated Axel's executive director, Janice Bellucci. And so what happens next after that, then?
Well, the court stated that the parties shall proceed to discovery in due course. After discovery has closed and defendants have certified that the administrative record is complete, they may move for summary judgment on the four of the plaintiff's claims. And this case could drag on for another year or more. But I'm afraid in summary judgment that bad things can happen. I'm one of those who don't want questions that don't need to be answered to be presented. I just don't see the reason for this case.
And from my point of view, this is, it's establishing a standard that you don't want to have a standard established for. Is that a reasonable way to word it?
You're running the risk. If this judge says there is a federal duty to register, and that these regulations are good, but they just need a little bit of tweaking to make it clear that you have this federal duty to register. If I'm the U.S. Department of Justice, I've won something I never in my wildest mind thought I could win. I've got the opportunity to prosecute tens of thousands of people who have been discharged from registration by judicial orders. And then you're going to have to litigate those claims later, saying that it disrupts the judicial order. And you've got an appellate level decision saying that this is fine and good stuff. I'd rather not have this decision. Now, if I'm wrong and it comes back that everything's hunky-dory and they win, then I'll say, too bad, so sad, I was wrong. But I don't like litigating, doing risky litigation. This seems to be a very risky gamble to me.
And the federal DA, so the Attorney General, do you think they would then go on a witch hunt to find us all?
If they have that power, here's what they would do. If they have the power, clearly the courts interpret that there is a federal obligation independent of what the state has said and the state's rights have been extinguished and that the states have to register people that they don't wish to register, that they've already discharged. I could see when we have a president in the executive branch that says, I want the laws enforced to the fullest extent and maximum penalties. I could see that because they have unlimited resources financially. There has never been a cut in my lifetime to the U.S. Department of Justice budget. It just grows and grows and grows. And I think that you're asking for trouble, folks.
And in chat, and I was having a good day until now, Larry. So thanks for that. Haven't you argued with some of the the attorneys that kind of go around like the Narsal orbit about whether there is a federal duty to register. You've just spent 10 minutes saying there's no federal duty to register, but you've argued with lawyers that there is.
Well, courts have said there is. So the Wilbin case said there is.
And there's nothing written in any doctrine or whatever law anywhere that says that there's a federal duty to register.
Well, there's in the Sixth Circuit, there is such a ruling that has been interpreted that way. That's the recklessness I'm worried about. Now there's an independent federal duty in the Sixth Circuit.
I see.
Folks, why do you want an independent duty to register? Why are you asking a question that we don't need an answer?
All right. We will move along, and I'm certain that this is going to come back around, don't you think?
I'm certain it will.
This will not be the last time we cover this.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, and then finally, you put in a case here from Idaho. What is this about?
This case is Does versus Roll Labrador, the Attorney General of Idaho. It was dismissed and is now on remand from the Ninth Circuit because the appeal was successful.
I see. All right. The plaintiffs are six men and women who must register for life under Idaho's SORNA and Community Right to Know Act. So here in Idaho, SORA. Plaintiffs were each charged or convicted before 2006 when the Idaho legislature began amending SORA to impose increasingly harsh restrictions. That sounds familiar. That sounds like what pretty much every state has done. How many times has Idaho amended their SORA regulations?
Well, Idaho's original PFR law came into effect July 1, 1993. The law imposed only a duty for persons convicted of certain felony crimes to register with their local sheriff, and the registry was not available to the public. But in 1998, the Idaho legislature repealed the 1993 law and passed SORA, and SORA created a central registry and information on the registry public available. It also delineated 17 registrable offenses and expanded the category required to register. And in terms of how many times, it's going to take me forever, but it basically it's been amended every year, 2001, 2002, 2004, 2005, on and on and on, all the way through 2020. It's been amended. Each set of amendments was applied retroactively in the same manner as the 1998 version of SORA.
When was the original case filed?
This case is old. It was filed in September of 2016.
And then, so for some background and context, on appeal, the Ninth Circuit found no error in the court's analysis of plaintiff's vagueness, free association, equal protection, contracts clause, takings, separation of powers, and state police power challenges, and affirmed dismissal of those claims. The Ninth Circuit found the court only erred in dismissing plaintiff's ex post facto and free exercise claims, and accordingly, in dismissing plaintiff's Eighth Amendment and double jeopardy claims on the same basis. What is left for their trial court to decide then?
Well, the two things are the ex post facto and the free exercise claims related to religious exercise. And that's a significant claim there, that free exercise is ingrained in our Constitution.
Yeah, like First Amendment kind of stuff. Are these facial or as applied challenges?
I had trouble in the brief time I had. It was difficult to determine which these are.
What would you mind if could you go through and explain what facial versus applied means?
A facial challenge is when you challenge the entire legislative enactment or provision. You're arguing that there are no set of circumstances that such an enactment could be constitutional. And as applied challenge, you do not look at the text or the face of the statute because it could be constitutional in many circumstances, but rather you argue that the law is valid on its face, But it nonetheless, it's unconstitutionally as it's being applied in a particular case or situation like your own. So you say, yes, you could do this, but you just can't do it to me, and here's why. Here's why I fit into a constitutional carve-out. I'm protected. You can't do that to me.
On page 18, the court stated, nevertheless, given the Ninth Circuit's holding in Wasden, the court must, in evaluating the instant motion to dismiss, consider only whether plaintiffs have plausibly alleged that SORA, on its face, is punitive in effect. Wasden, 982 Federal 3rd at 791? If plaintiffs have done so and survived defendant's motion to exist, they will nonetheless face a heavy burden when seeking to override a legislative expression of intent that a challenged provision is civil, and only the clearest of proof will suffice to meet that burden on summary judgment or at trial. What is the legal test you refer to over and over and over again?
Well, it's the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez factors from the U.S. Supreme Court in 1963. And there are seven of them, but the courts mostly rely on these five, and they include whether the law, one, inflicts sanctions which have historically been regarded as punishment, two, imposes an affirmative disability restraint, that's my favorite, three, promotes the traditional aims of punishment, four, has a rational correlation to a non-punitive purpose, and five, is excessive in respect to its stated purpose.
Just in my mind, some of those other ones, like inflict sanctions which have historically been regarded as punishment, telling people where they can and can't live seems like that would be considered punishment, Larry.
Well, and locking them up for living places where they where they're not allowed to live is definitely punishment.
Or even where they're not supposed to be, like in North Carolina, where like the registration office or the to go visit your politician is in the mall, which is right next door to a daycare. How are you supposed to function in a democracy where you are not allowed to be present where your politician is working?
You're going to have to find another option.
All right. The plaintiffs highlight they are required to report annually in person and must provide a photograph, 23 fingerprints and palm prints. I only have 10 fingers, Larry. How do you get to 23?
That was a typo.
Oh, okay. I was like, damn. So, okay. I was like, butt print. I was trying to figure out what else you could do. In addition to yearly mandatory reporting, plaintiffs must report in person within 2 working days whenever certain information changes, including a changing in name. That probably doesn't happen too often. Residence, more often. Employment, somewhat often. Student status. Immediate reporting is required for any changes in vehicle information. That probably happens a lot. And internet usernames, a lot, as well as for any lodging or travel that is 7 days or longer. There are no good cause exceptions to the notification and reporting requirements. And regardless of illness, injury, transportation issues, or other emergencies, plaintiffs must report within 2 days or face criminal charges. The current version of SOAR imposes penalties of up to 10 years imprisonment for violating the law. Can you admit that Idaho's law does impose disabilities and restraints and also inflict sanctions which have historically been regarded as punishment? I'm going to add that.
I can indeed. And the court stated on page 34, given the burdensome extent of reporting requirements and the criminal sanctions associated with failure to comply, plaintiffs plausibly allege their lives and travel are supervised in ways that resemble probation and parole. Like parolees, plaintiffs contend they are not free to move where they wish to or live and work as other citizens without supervision. And they relied on Smith versus Doe, which is the presidential case from the U.S. Supreme Court, 538 U.S. at 101. And I cite to pages 100 and 101 all the time, the disabilities of restraint, that is the most important thing that they said in that entire case that we can win on. We've got to focus on proving the disabilities and restraints.
And not recidivism, right?
I don't give a brat's ass about recidivism.
All right. So I see that. Also, the court noted that plaintiffs plausibly allege SORA resembles, at least in some respects, the ancient punishment of banishment. Specifically, the current version of SORA bars plaintiffs from residing within 500 feet of a school or daycare, measured from the nearest point of the exterior wall of the registrant's dwelling unit to the school or daycare's property line. That's better than other places where they do it property line to property line, Larry, because that's only, it's the exterior wall of the registrant's dwelling.
So plaintiffs also know that the current version of SOAR bars them from loitering within 500 feet from the property line of a school or a daycare, playgrounds, including properties posted with a notice that they are used by a school or daycare anytime their children are present at the school or daycare for regular activities, or within 30 minutes before or after such activities. How on earth would you know all that kind of stuff as a PFR?
Especially when your internet access is restricted, how are you supposed to know where all of the daycares and all those playgrounds and all that stuff might be?
Well, how would you know when the activities are going on?
Well, you could use the internet to go see what their calendar is, Larry. You are super big on this disabilities and restraints. How are they doing on those particular elements?
They're doing good so far. SORA specifically limits plaintiff's ability to travel. For instance, plaintiffs must provide in-person notice of their presence to law enforcement in a jurisdiction to which they travel, even if such jurisdictions do not impose the registration requirement. Now, we see that all the time. A person is told by their home, you got to go and check in with the PFR office. You get to the PFR office of the jurisdiction, they say, we don't have any interest in you. You're only going to be here for 24 hours. But anyway, yep. because PFR laws are so complex and vary from state to state, it's difficult for registrants to obtain accurate information about either affirmative reporting obligations, such as registering one's presence in a state, or prohibitions on ordinary behavior, such as visiting a library, a park, and so forth. And plaintiffs allege that they even avoid interstate travel due to the risk of unintentionally violating SORA. That's the sad thing about this, when people are afraid to travel, which is one of your fundamental freedoms. But they're doing great so far.
I don't know how much we were talking at the time, but the first time that I traveled when I was on supervision, my handler says, well, make sure you go visit the registry office. And I get up to where I was going and the guy's like, I'm not signing that. I was like, but they told me to get you to sign it. Not signing it. Now I'm like, now what do? I've left home. I need to get this guy to sign it to prove that I went where I said I was going to go. He won't sign it. How am I supposed to win that battle when I get home? He's like, well, you didn't get it signed. How do I know that you went where you said you were going to go? But I could take a selfie in front of the office, maybe.
But you're not allowed to have a smartphone.
All right. Footnote 28 states, of course, to succeed on the merits of their ex post facto claim, plaintiffs will have to establish with evidence that SOAR imposes substantial occupational and or housing disadvantages for registrants that would not have otherwise occurred through the use of routine background checks by employers and landlords. And that's from Smith 538 U.S. at 100. Does that mean they could still lose on this point?
Oh, yes, it does mean that. The court's ruling is only on the state's motion to dismiss. The court has found that the plaintiffs have plausibly alleged SOAR imposes significant restrictions on housing and employment. That's a much lower standard than what's required to prevail on the merits. Remember, they have to show by the clearest of proof.
You are absolutely Mr. Doom and Gloom tonight, Larry.
All right.
Yeah. And so back to what I just brought up a minute ago about you absolutely detest the recidivism argument. I noticed that this has been raised as a defense by the state. Has the judge given any hint as to where he's at on that issue?
Not really. The judge noted ultimately the court finds further SOAR's extensive regulations actually assist law enforcement and parents in protecting Idaho's children and communities and prevent recidivism or issues appropriately reserved for summary judgment after the parties have had the opportunity to develop the record. The judge has already telegraphed us this case is going to be decided with summary judgment, so we shall see.
And oh God, so this is always confusing to me. I know you hate summary judgment, but is this one of those times where summary judgment is good for us?
Remember, we carry the burden of proof. I would like to see a trial on any issue where there's any doubt that the evidence is not sufficient. You need to tell judge, I'm sorry. We've got 32 witnesses we're going to call on this. It's going to require 2 days to hear from the witnesses. The court's going to have to clear their calendar, Your Honor. That's what you got to tell the judge.
And do you think they'll do that?
Probably not.
All right. The conclusion reads, in part, plaintiffs have plausibly alleged that SOAR is so punitive in effect that it negates the Idaho legislature's intent to enact a civil regulatory scheme. As such, plaintiffs' ex post facto and double jeopardy claims survive the instant motion to dismiss. Given the Ninth Circuit's holding in Wasden, 982 Federal 3rd at 794, the court also finds plaintiffs' FERPA. What is FERPA?
It's the Free Exercise of Protected Free Exercise of Religion Protected Act of Idaho, and it gives
oh,
a
I
section
see.
There. So
okay, the court, so yeah, go.
The court also stated all plaintiffs may litigate each of their claims. It is important to note that the court is not at this juncture holding SORA as facially unconstitutional. To find SORA unconstitutional, only the clearest of proof will suffice to override legislative intent and transform what has been denominated as a civil remedy into a criminal penalty. Folks, the judge is telling you, you better come loaded. You better come with proof.
It seems not hard to develop this proof in my mind. Maybe I'm naive or Pollyanna about it, but it doesn't seem very difficult to prove that a lot of the SORNA regulation stuff is very much disabilities and restraints.
Well, some of it will be obvious because the state will be forced to make stipulations that these laws are being actively enforced. But when you say I didn't get a job because of
yeah.
the registry, that's very subjective. We don't know that you didn't get a job because of the registry. We just you don't have the proof of that. You're speculating.
Yeah. I know I'm with you on that. And then how many jobs did you not apply for that maybe you were qualified for just because of some level of fear of how you were applying, that you wouldn't be selected, so you just opted out instead of trying to go get a higher paying job?
So
that would be very hard to prove as well.
This case is going to be running for quite some time, even though it's several years old. It's got a ways to go, and now that it's survived and it's back in the district court level, I'm going to try to reach out to the attorneys and see if we can be of any help.
Do you have good feelings about it in general, though?
I do. I think that they've got a great opportunity there to make some progress, but they got to do it right. Can't
if
do
they
it on
want
low,
any free, you if can't they want do any free low, publicity, they could do it here.
You can't do it on low budget and hope for the best. You got to go in with proof.
You and your money all the time, Larry. You're all about the money.
That's right.
I know. And someone in chat says Larry's favorite phrase, summary judgment.
Yeah, that's my favorite. All right.
All right. Well, we are going to close out the show. I know it's shorter than normal, but again, Larry is probably sweating. I can just picture him in there. It's just glistening down his head because the air conditioner is dead and he's in a very hot part of the country with no AC. So I just want to announce that because of the conference, interacting with a bunch of people, we got 4 new patrons. So we had Families for a Better Florida, who is listening in chat tonight. And then we also had Christian, Lucky, I think I know who that one is, and then also Randall. And then we also had some snail mail people, right?
We did. We have, Frank, who's in Ohio. He's a guest in the BOP. And we have Daniel in Arizona, who's a guest in the Arizona Department of Corrections. And I want to offer my apology to one of our subscribers, Benjamin. He sent a letter, and I intended to use parts of it. The letter didn't get scanned, and the letter is gone. So, Benjamin, if you can remember what you wrote to us, write it again, and we'll look at some of those questions that you sent that are no longer around.
Very good. As a reminder, I said it all at the beginning. The show notes you can find over at registrymatters.co, and then the transcripts you can usually find over at fypeducation.org. And then if you want to leave voicemail, 747-227-4477, at email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And then finally, it is so important and appreciated to us that we have the support of our patrons. And you can do that over at at patreon.com/registrymatters. As always, Larry, I think that you are amazing and I appreciate all the work that you do and put in. And if we could give you a virtual round of applause, thank you for all that you do, buddy. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. And all the thousands that showed up this evening at the conference, we had them packed in like sardines in that room.
That was a funny episode, Larry, because when you started, you were like hunched over and you were like, I feel lousy. And then we start getting you talking and you perk up and you get excited and you start getting more animated. And we had a lot of fun. It was a great time.
All right. Well, we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Very good. I'll talk to you soon, Larry. Have a great night.
Night.
You've been listening to FYP.